Well, good morning. Go ahead and find your seats. And we got to do it one more time. He is risen. Oh, man, I hope you're having a great day. What an honor it is to be with you and to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. Today, I just want you to know that no matter what is occurring in your world, in your life, in your story, that you're loved by God and that you are loved by us. And I just want to start by simply saying welcome to anyone who this is the first time you've ever been with us as a community at the Square. It's just a privilege and honor to have you. I recognize that on Easter, we have so many people with us. We have family and friends from who live here and who live in other places. We have people who have been part of our church for a long time, and we have people who haven't been to church in a long time. And there are those here who are questioning what they believe or how to believe, those who are uncertain if they should believe at all. And I just want you to know that wherever you're at in the story, you matter to us, and you have a place here. And if there's anything we can do to love you or serve you, we would consider it an honor to do so. And today, I actually want to just invite you into a few thoughts out of Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. As a church family, we are walking verse by verse through the book of Ephesians, and we found ourselves at this perfect moment to stop and celebrate the resurrection of Jesus together today. But I also want to just say this, that we hold so deeply to the conviction of the resurrection of Jesus. The resurrection is the anchor of our faith. And I want you to know that our belief in the resurrection of Jesus is not simply hopefulness or a feeling, that we believe in the trustworthiness of the resurrection of Jesus intellectually. We believe it trustworthy archaeologically. We believe it trustworthy historically. We believe it to be the fundamental truth of the world. And we honor that if you're here and you're saying, hey, you're coming and speaking about this incredible idea of resurrection, but why do you believe? I just want to honor you and tell you that we would love to walk with you and share those truths and share those convictions that we carry, because we believe that the resurrection of Jesus stands as the arc of human history. And today, I simply want to speak what I believe the significance and the invitation of the resurrection is for us. And this is what Ephesians 5, 1 and 2 says. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Yeah, the amazing thing about the stories of the scriptures and moments in the Bible is that when you slow down, they always hold more than you could have ever imagined. And what I have learned as I've sat with these two verses, that simply within these two verses is maybe the whole story of life itself. It is bound within these phrases and words is the hope of why we believe, the hope of what we believe, and the hope of what we believe God has come to do in and through us. And I actually love, because when you stop and slow down, what you begin to see is that there's really four things that are happening. And I want to invite you in to see these with me. In essence, Paul is saying you're becoming something because you are something, because Jesus did something that now declares something. It's these four pieces that tell the story of resurrection and Easter. It's these four pieces that tell the fundamental story of life. That there is something you're becoming, but that something you're becoming is a picture of something that you already are. And that thing that you are is a result of something Jesus has done. And that thing that Jesus has done has begun to declare something to the world. The very reason we stop and we celebrate today. And it's here we see this very first line where Paul writes in Ephesians 5:1, therefore, be imitators of God. Be imitators of God. Now, what's interesting about this passage is I actually think it leads us, and not because the words are necessarily wrong, but we have this way with our own language where we have this almost self-interpretation that we do in the midst of it. At least I do that. I don't know if you do. But it's often when I read passages, the first thing that I need to stop and pay attention to is the internal voice within myself to hear what is actually being said. Because when I read this passage, this is what I hear in that first line. My first gut reaction is this invitation to be something that I seem to keep failing at being. I read Ephesians 5:1, this very first line, to hear this call of this radical witness of life to be an imitator of God. And the first thought I have is how much I fall short. And this desire, even where it comes from a place of good desire, but this desire to somehow in my own life and in my own strength to figure out how could somebody live like this, to live so rightly, to live so truly, that this vision of life like that Paul puts in front of us, that God himself is speaking to us, that you are invited to be an imitator of God, it immediately moves me to this place of trying to figure out how. And isn't this interesting how for so many of us, the subtle invitations of the way we walk out life tell us all of the places that we have trouble believing Jesus. I honestly believe that most people in this room, whether you are a Christian or you are someone who is searching out the faith, we have this shared belief that there's something we have to prove and earn. And if we don't figure out how to prove it and we don't figure out how to earn it, then we'll never have it. And I think there's this broken reality inside of us that strives and strives or gets angry at striving and then just begins to walk the other direction. Oh, to be an imitator of God. And the subtle voice of our own hearts and lives that do not know how to find this very thing we've been invited to be. But when you actually look at what Paul's writing, the words almost become an unfortunate invitation of our own language, because the invitation is not to be something. In fact, the exact word that gets translated is therefore be. It's one word in the Greek. It literally means to become something. The invitation is to become an imitator of God. And can I just tell you that I believe that you were made for this very truth? That God's desire for your life is that somehow in and through him and in and through all that he's doing, he would meet you right where you are and he would begin to teach you day by day, step by step, moment by moment, how to become like him. And I know this seems small, but this is the inherent hope of the gospel. There is a profound difference between the invitation to be something you don't know how to be and to become something that Jesus has already done for you. And see, this is the power of the invitation of Jesus. He does not lay demands that we do not know how to fulfill or cannot fulfill. He, our forerunner, fulfills them first, and then like a father, walks in the journey of becoming what we had no power and authority once to be. And it's this picture that begins to set the stage. You are invited to become an imitator of God because of something that you are. See, this is what Paul says, therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children. As beloved children. There's this phrase that we have as a church, and it's kind of this statement that gets used in our emails or gets put on logos or gets said from the time to time or many times. And it's this very simple phrase that in many ways captures the heart and the identity of our church, which is, know you're loved. And the truth is, this phrase, where it all started, was with my staff mocking me, as all good things should begin, right? That I have this way of saying things over and over again in ways I don't fully see or understand. I have all of these random colloquialisms, or I make up words while I'm preaching. And my staff, I think, has a running list of all the different verses I've said are my favorite verse in the Bible, which is about 40 or 50. And so I didn't realize this, but apparently in the first years of our church, whenever I would meet with people or I would sit with people or I'd say it on Sundays, I would have this way of just saying, know you're loved. And then there was this moment, we were in the office in the parsonage by the church. And I remember I walked in and our staff was just like kind of joking about this. And it was this realization of how bled into our culture, this thing I didn't realize I said over and over again, because I'm annoying in some ways like that, it was so fascinating that suddenly this moment of fun and teasing was this realization that, oh, this really is embedded in everything we do. And then suddenly it was like this sense of joking kind of ceased in everyone. And it was this, oh, this captures something real. This is actually the substance of who we are. That if we could say one thing above anything, it would be this simple truth that you are loved. In this last season, I've stopped and I've realized how deep this story actually goes in my life. Because the language that just naturally began to emerge in my own heart and life as we planted the square was simply the foundation of the language and the story of my life. That my own dad, who my parents are just heroes in my life, they are just remarkable men and women, and my dad, I remember this, that if there was one thing my father told me more than anything else, he would pull me aside and he would just simply say, do you know how much I love you? My father is not an emotional man. I would have a hard time remembering seeing my dad cry very often, but my dad was highly involved in my life. He coached every baseball team I was ever on. He was a very devoted father. Like, I am so fortunate. I consider myself one of the lucky ones to have parents like I've had and to have this anchor. And my parents are imperfect, as all parents are imperfect, but there was one thing above all things that they got right, which is the one thing above all things anyone here who has children must get right, which is that they built a foundation of, I knew simply this, I was loved. I remember my dad would coach my base. I have this memory. I was on an 11-year-old game. It was a random baseball game. My dad was the third base coach. It was a pitch that got behind the catcher. Nothing big, nothing important happening. And my dad calls me up to him. And I'm like, I don't know. He's going to tell me to bunt or something. I don't know what he's going to do. It's my coach. He's going to tell me something to do. And he pulls me in and he looks at me and goes, do you know how much I love you? I'm like, Dad, this is not the time. What are you doing? Like, I mean, literally, it was just like, and I would always do the same. I'd be like, yeah, Dad, I know. You tell me all the time. It was got to this place of annoyance. I roll my eyes. And he would always say the same thing. You don't. You don't. But one day you will. And I knew that he was speaking of the day I would understand the heart of a father by becoming a father. And I learned he was right. I didn't know. In this picture, though, of what happened in my own life, as I've grown, I've begun to realize is ultimately the fundamental story of who God is and what it has created. My dad created a space in my life that I have never experienced in any other relationship. And part of it is I believe, the true identity that fathers are meant to carry. I still remember in my life, I struggled with lots of things, experienced lots of pain and death in my world. And I, even though I had this genuine and sincere life with God and family, I began to walk away, a prodigal journey and season in my life. And I remember this moment. It's hard to explain all of the circumstances, but I was walking away and living in secrets in all these worlds. I had this moment in my junior year in high school where I was at one of my friend's house, and it was here that their father actually began to abuse them and threw them down the stairs and threw them against the wall. And I still have this visual in my mind of my friend literally just going, "Phil, just leave. And I didn't know what to do. I was overwhelmed by this situation that just suddenly got out of control. And I remember I get in my car and I just drive to my house, and my dad was supposed to be at work, but for whatever reason, he gotten home early, and I was there, and my dad was standing on the porch of our house in Idaho Falls, Idaho, this tiny little town that I grew up in, and I remember just like my body was so visibly shaken, my emotions, I just experienced this moment, I didn't know what to do, and my dad looked at me, and he goes, "Phil, what's wrong?" And it was like I knew the only way that I could actually explain to him what was wrong was telling lots of stories and moments and situations that I was not in the moment and heart to do. And I remember feeling this tension, everything inside of me just wanted to be like, "Hey, Dad, let me tell you what's actually going on in my life." But I was so ashamed. I was so afraid. So I just stood there. I mean, I remember my dad just for like minutes, he just watched me, and I just stood there like I was frozen. And eventually my dad just set down what was in his hands, and he came. He just wrapped his arms around me. I just began to weep. And he just said, I remember him speaking in my ear, "Hey, if you can't tell me, tell him. He loves you the most. He loves you the most." These moments in my life have shaped me. Still to this day, there's these moments and situations where all I want is a conversation with my dad. I've come to see, and I bet many of you will resonate this, maybe specifically the men will resonate that. In every situation in my life, I'm responsible for something. I have an identity in something. I have a burden in something. My mom, who has shaped my life probably more than any other human being alive, the wake of her love is evident in who I am. But even towards my mom, I as a man, I feel this deep love and responsibility to care for her. She's my mother. There's always a sense of responsibility. Oh, but when I'm with my dad, I don't have to be anything other than the one thing that's truest of me. I am a beloved son. I'm not a pastor. I'm not a leader. I'm not thinking of all of the cascading implications. I get to be a son. Even recently, in difficult decisions, things that are hard, things that I'm wrestling through, I just called my dad months ago, and I was like, "Hey, Dad," and he's like, "Hey, what's up, bud?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know." That's like his statement of like, he knows. He goes, "Oh, okay. Do you want to talk about anything?" "No, Dad, I don't." "Okay. Yeah, I love you." "Yeah, Dad. I know that. You carrying a lot?" "Yeah, it feels like I'm carrying a lot." "Do you need anything?" "No, I just needed to be a son for a minute." And I've come into this place in my life where I've realized this is what fathers do, or what fathers were created to do. And I honor that. I long to live up to the legacy of my father. You might be here and a father yourself, or the storyline with your father, I'm not sure. And I honor where the challenges are present in that. But it's this truth, that in the presence of my father, no matter what's happening, no matter how I'm doing, no matter whether I'm winning or failing, no matter whether I'm succeeding or losing, no matter whether I am living as I should or as I shouldn't, there is a space of love that is the truest picture of the reality of God himself. I want you to know this. And you might believe what I'm about to say intellectually, or maybe you'll wrestle with it. But we often, no matter our intellectual beliefs, struggle to come to this conclusion that you are irrevocably, wildly, and foolishly loved by God, no matter the state or condition of your life or your decisions. We have a God who loves his enemies, who loves those who reject him, who loves those who condemn him, who loves those who don't know what to do with him. Friends, there is one truth in the world. I may not know you. There are many in this room. I have never had the chance to meet you. I don't know your name, and I don't pretend to have an intimacy with you. Don't, but I do know this. I know the greatest truth of your life. Because the single greatest truth of your life is that you are loved by God. And see, it's that love that creates the space to become what you could never become on your own. It is not until you actually know how loved you are that you'll begin to live into the identity and the expression of who God has made you to be. All becoming starts with being. And this, more than anything else, is the hope of Easter. You are a beloved son or daughter. And it is because of this that you now have the invitation to become an imitator of God in the world, to become like him, through him, for him, and by him. See, this is what we often misunderstand. Let me tell you the truth of what I believe. If the issue of life was around being loved, there would be no issue in life. If salvation was a matter of how loved people are, the world would be saved. But it is only through the radical reality of love that opens the door to become an adopted son or daughter in Jesus. Because it's in the wake of this love, when we finally yield, when we finally come to him and allow him to lead in our lives through salvation like he's always longed for, this is the place we not only become beloved, we become children through the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. See, the world would say being loved is enough. I would argue being loved is everything, but being loved opens the door to what actually allows the transformation of Jesus into our life. It is the fact that we are loved that we can become like him. But you can be loved and stay not like him. You can run for your entire life in another direction and still be loved by him. But to become like him is to become part of him, and to become part of him is to yield your life and to receive him. I'm done believing that the message of Christianity is somehow unfairly exclusive. I'm done trying to cater to our secular ideals that say, well, if God was really loving, he would what? He would what? He would die for you? I agree. He would not invite you to be part of him, to bring transformation into you. See, the challenge of the gospel is that it is the most radically inclusive, exclusive message in existence. And the secular ideology of our world wants to drop all of the exclusiveness, and the radical, pharisaical, legalistic part of the church wants to drop all of the inclusiveness. And I'm just here to tell you, do not live your life simply believing in the messages of the fringe. Do not believe your life with the voice of the Pharisee to one side and the voice of secular society to the other. It is Jesus alone who stands apart in the middle with the truest message of hope. Which is that you are loved wildly. And this love is an invitation to what you can become. But it's this becoming an imitator of God, because you are a beloved child of God, is a result because Jesus did something. And it's this picture that Paul gives that he says, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. That worship team can come back up. This, what I love about this picture is that it's actually telling us something subtle that 2,000 years later from Paul writing the book of Ephesians, we would have trouble recognizing. For those who have been part of our church over this last season, you know several weeks ago when we talked about that, actually what Paul is doing here in Ephesians 4, and he's continuing even to this moment, he's using a picture that was incredibly familiar with the people of the Roman world. He's using a picture of the triumph. And the Roman triumph, as I shared several weeks ago with you, is this moment that's sacred in the history of Rome. It's only happened a handful of times. It was reserved for emperors. That we see the lore around Caesar Augustus walking into his victory, becoming the new king of the world, becoming the emperor of the world. And it's here this Roman triumph was the moment where he went from a general to a king. He went from a human to a demigod. He went from something of this world to something beyond it. And it's this imagery that Paul begins to tell our story through. Who are we and how do we live? We are the triumph of Jesus, and we live through the triumph of Jesus. And right, this parade of triumph, the Caesar comes riding through the streets of Rome, throwing gifts to the people. He has slaves of all of the nations he's conquered behind him. He has the war spoils of all of the places he's been in this incredible display. He ultimately has his generals around him. It's this incredible picture of the new emperor riding in the chariot, face painted like the sun, on display, declaring the triumph of Rome. And the triumph would always end in one specific destination. It would always go to the temple of Jupiter. With the very last moments of the triumph, the processional, was that the emperor would come and he would walk, and he would walk up these great stairs at the ancient temple of Jupiter in Rome, and he would sit on his throne. And then slaves would come and they would bring these two white bulls, and they would sacrifice. One as a sacrifice of offering, and one as a sacrifice of appeasing. And it was here in these moments where these two sacrifices would take place that the king, sitting on his throne, would stand. And he would just simply declare triumph. And it was as he did this, there would be priests in the temple of Jupiter, and they would have these sticks, these luminaires, and they would have lights on them and incense on them. And there was this actually sacred fragrance they only held for this occasion. There's commentators and writers who talk about this fragrance of the triumph. And suddenly the entire atmosphere would begin to be filled with this smell, this fragrance. And hundreds of priests would actually light from torch to torch each other. And suddenly they'd begin to move out in this crowd of thousands and thousands and thousands. And suddenly the entire area and empire would, in this metaphorical way, in this space, would begin to be filled with this aroma. It's Paul, when he's writing you about this moment of this invitation to become an imitator of God. What an invitation. But it's an invitation of becoming because of something that you are in this beloved son and daughter. And it's here that you're meant to see what makes Jesus, Jesus. Because what Paul tells us is not that Jesus's triumph was the one where he climbs his throne and sacrifices are made to appease him. He is the king who descends his throne and becomes the sacrifice and the offering himself. It's hard, I think, to put language around like this picture. But this is the gospel. And this is at the heart of why we celebrate Easter. Because the kings of this world, and us, if we could, we long to ascend our thrones But there's one king who descended it. And not only descended it and he became the offering and the sacrifice for us. I mean, close your eyes. Paul's meant to have this moment where you're imagining the triumph of Jesus. The parade has gone by. The new king has ridden and he's thrown gifts of meaning and purpose and identity, and you've received one. And now you're watching all the victory and all the celebration taking place. And suddenly Jesus, the king, ascends to his throne, and you're just waiting like, where are the people who are going to come? And then suddenly something different starts to happen. Jesus doesn't stand while slaves around him come and do this work. Step by step, Jesus comes down onto the altar himself. And the sacrifice of union is him. He's the God who descends. He's the God who walks down. He's the God who empties himself. He's the God who becomes what we were so we could become what he is. This is why there's no one like Jesus. Because he is the only king who becomes sin so that sin can become whole. He's the only king that leaves his throne to make room for people like us to be loved. To be loved. See this picture, you're becoming an imitator of God because you are a beloved child of God, because Jesus is the king who descends. It's the fact that he stepped down from his throne that creates the space for us to be born sons and daughters. But this picture is meant to tell us something that, very simply, in the phrase of Paul, this fragrant offering, this fragrant smell that now cascades out the world. And it's Jesus descends because what it declares, what the fragrance declared, was triumph. So Caesar Augustus would sit on his throne, and the sacrifice was made, and the incense was burned, and the smell, hundreds and hundreds of priests. I mean, literally, just the smell would spread for miles around the square room. That as Caesar declared triumph, a chant would begin in the crowd of people. For hours, we have historians talk to us, for hours, they would just begin to cry, triumph, triumph. Triumph, triumph, as the aroma spread throughout the entire city. And this is the gospel of Jesus. That because he's the king who descends, he's the king who comes down from his throne, he's the king who becomes the sacrifice. Now, as the fragrant aroma moves, it's you and I that begin to, everywhere we go and in everything we do and in every moment we're a part of, by walking in love, begin to declare the triumph of Jesus. And it's like this cyclical way Paul's wrapping around from the beginning of going, you want to know what it looks like to be an imitator of God? It's becoming the kind of person who makes room of belovedness for people in process. For people who don't know who they are and don't know how to be, and they don't know how to tell you everything, because if they did, the shame and the pain and the stories of their life would spill out in ways they're not ready for. But they need to know a fundamental question: are they loved? And somehow you, this little you, gets to be an imitator of the one who loved you, that gets to create this space for someone else to be beloved. And you get to be like Jesus, the one who descends down to come underneath someone else. And by coming underneath somebody else, you get to subtly, with every part of your life, just get to declare the song of the ages, triumph. There is a God who saves. There's a God who heals. There's a God who loves. And there's a God who delivers. And it's put on display through the very ones he's loved and healed and delivered. Because this story is the declaration of the transformation of the world, because what Paul will tell us is this is the triumph of Jesus. That those who were once dead in their trespasses and sins have been made alive with Jesus. The triumph is resurrection. The triumph is dead things come back to life. The triumph is the dead parts of me don't stay dead. The dead parts of you. The triumph is the restoration of who you were truly meant to be. And as Paul, speaking on this very same idea in Philippians 2, says this: in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Jesus, who, being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking on the nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, being found in the appearance of a man. He humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of the Father. See, the King who descends for us is the King who now, through resurrection life, his name is above every name. His authority is above every authority, because the power of Jesus is not that he once was ascended, it's that he chose to descend. And by the power of resurrection, the Father replaced Jesus back into who he was, into the position he rightly had. That now, at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue confess. And it's this story that now invites us into the fullness of our lives. You are alive to be the triumph of God. You are alive to declare the triumph of God. You are alive to experience the triumph of God, which is this: he has died that you might live, that you might live. And not in an understanding intellectually, not in an understanding theologically. Can I tell you, he wants you to live. He wants you to be alive. He wants your marriage alive. He wants your relationships alive. He wants your story alive. The name above every name has authority over everything in our lives. The question is whether we see it. The hum and the beat of the song, triumph, triumph, triumph. The aroma of Christ as servants and slaves in the name of Jesus go from town to town, getting underneath people. Why? Because they're loved. The single greatest mark of your life could be this: that you would create a space in others' lives so true that they would get in your presence and just go, I don't have to be anything than what I am most truly, which is loved. Because this is how he loved us. And he loved us first, so that we could love like him, his imitators, the God of triumph. So it is my prayer this Easter that as you celebrate the resurrection of Jesus, as you consider the resurrection of Jesus, you would see the invitation of putting the resurrection on display everywhere you go. And you put, isn't it fascinating, the resurrection on display one way: through crosses. It's the mystery of the world that the resurrection of heaven is most perfectly seen by those who are willing to lay down their lives for someone else. The one who lived died that we might live, and now we live not for ourselves, but for him who died and rose again on our behalf. Let God write the story of the triumph in your life. Don't celebrate a holiday. Don't celebrate a custom. Find the resurrected King. Would you stand with me I'm going to pray, and we're just going to close at a place of worship and response. I'll come afterwards and pray with you and send us on our way. Jesus, we love you and we honor you. We ask that you would meet us here and minister to us. We come and just say thank you, that you really love us. No matter where you're at, you really love us. God, would we allow your love to anchor our lives, to become who you've called us to become. And we say thank you that Jesus went on our behalf into death, and he went on our behalf into new life. And now we get to live from the resurrection life of Jesus. In your name. Come on, let's worship.